Welcome to Basic Folk. This is a podcast where we have honest conversations with folk musicians. I'm your host, Cindy Howes, and I am recording this in the past. It is Friday, October 16th. This is being released on Thursday, November 5th, which is a couple of days after the United States election. So I don't know how we're all feeling right now, whether we are needing a distraction or if we are celebrating. But regardless of the situation, I hope you are taking care of yourselves and taking care of each other. Today on the podcast, we're going to be talking to Lori McKenna. She is on Basic Folk talking about her new album, The Balladeer. Lori's been a huge part of the New England folk circuit for over two decades, and for the last 10 or so years has been a much in-demand songwriter in Nashville thanks to Faith Hill, Tim McGraw, and Mary Gaucher. Lori grew up and still lives in Stoughton, Massachusetts, and if you're keeping track at home, that is where the IKEA is. And she talks about her complicated relationship with her hometown and discovering how her home life is the secret ingredient to her incredible writing. Lori's a great storyteller, so we get a lot of stories about her brothers and sister, her dad, her husband, her kids, and of course, Mandy Moore. Lori talks about developing her confidence in songwriting. She didn't leave the house, actually, with her music until she was in her late 20s, even though she'd been writing since she was a young teen. She talks about the first song she ever wrote and played for her brother, actually, about a rodeo. It was the late 70s. She had never experienced a rodeo, never been exposed to rodeos, still has no idea where that came from, and I did the math to even make sure she couldn't have absorbed it from any Garth Brooks rodeo songs, which I think there's at least 10. From there, Lori just wrote to express herself, and the new album is filled with personal songs as well as one character song, which happens to be the title track. Lori McKenna gives us insights into her process, how this new record was made. And a personal note, Lori McKenna is a songwriting giant who has been hugely important and historical in my life. So it was an absolute honor to have her on the podcast. We're going to take a listen to one of the songs from Lori's new album, The Balladeer. And in fact, it is the title track, that character song that we were talking about. So let's check this out, and then we'll get to our conversation with the incredible Lori McKenna on Basic Folk.
The balladeer waits in the wings, tugging on a dress tune in her strings. All the whiskey-faded cigarette-blown dreams, she brings herself to her own knees. With every line so delicate, she sings every song that she knows. Way that she hears them sad and slow, they're never gonna play her on the radio. So she hangs in the darkest bars with downtrodden bleeding hearts. A guitar man there who knew all the chords said he needed her to help him find the words.
Okay, Lori McKenna.
Hi.
Thanks so much for being on Basic Folk.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, before we begin, I just want to thank you for when I was a freshman in college, I only listened to two albums, and one of them was Ani DiFranco, and the other one was Paper Wings and Halo.
Oh, wow.
Like, over and over and over and over again. I feel like it has the same effect as like if I put the Little Mermaid soundtrack on.
Like just brain, like nostalgia.
Yeah.
Really, that stuff works, man.
Yeah. You really kept me company during a very weird and dark time.
Oh.
So well, thank you.
Well, I'm glad that I kept you company, but I'm sorry that you had a weird and dark time, but I'm glad you threw it now.
Oh, yeah. Well, freshman year of college, as you may know with all of your kids, mm-hmm. can be, like, pretty challenging.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. You were born and raised in Stoughton, Massachusetts, which is actually 10 miles from my hometown of Walpole.
Wow.
And I want to say that you and I have like very different perspectives about our hometowns. I moved away from mine as soon as I could and don't ever want to live there again. But you have lived in Stoughton your entire life. What do you love about your town and what has kept you there?
It's funny, my relationship with this town has, it's like a marriage. It's had its ups and downs, and it's had its points where I totally would have, you know, signed divorce papers with the town of Stoughton, Massachusetts, if it was an easy divorce. But yeah, we've come a long way together, and I was that kid in high school that was like, I'm getting out of here, you know, and I just never did it. And I think that mostly my reasons were family. You know, I could walk to my dad's house, I can walk to the house that Gene grew up, my husband grew up in, and his family doesn't live there anymore, but my dad's still in his house, and my brother Richie lives on the road, that we grew up on. He bought a house on that same street, so I have family surrounding me everywhere. But by the time I was probably confident enough to move out of this town, you know, and like just take off and go, like I would have gone to Nashville, say, is I had kids in school. I always had kids in the school system somewhere.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to pull them out. But now I've really, you know, there's a lot of great people that live here. I have some just dear friends that live right around the corner from me at any direction. So I've really come to appreciate Stoughton and all of its good and bad, and you know, all of its changes. And as Mark Arelli will tell you, I've gotten a lot of songs out of this town, so I probably owe Stoughton, Mass, more than it owes me at this point.
Your family was all musical growing up, so what was the scene like at your house when it came to playing music?
Yeah, so I'm the youngest in my family, and everybody played at least, you know, piano. My brother Richie played guitar, so I sort of followed along with him. My other siblings all were pretty much piano-based. I wish I learned piano younger, but I didn't. I just took to the guitar, but it was just always music playing in the house. And we have a really tight family, and we were really tight when we were kids. And we've stayed really tight as adults, and it was just part of the family.
Can you talk about the family piano?
Yeah, the family piano is a console piano that's still at my dad's house. But the strange thing about my family is, I guess it's not that strange, but we all, you know, there's six of us. I have five siblings, and we all have at least one piano in our house.
You have two in this, actually three. Well, that I can see behind you.
There's a keyboard here and a little piano that's a baby piano. It only it's from like the 30s, but it was made for kids. And I have a piano upstairs. We have a piano in Nashville. My kids have a piano in Nashville. Like every time somebody moved in my family, they're like, "How can I find a cheap or free piano?" but we all have pianos. Like it's like it had to have been a big part of our childhood for us all to really need a piano in our houses when we became adults.
Can you speak to like the connection to that instrument?
I think it's just because you can just sit down. You can just sit down at it and take a seat. You don't have to play it, right? But it's just always right there. I think the fact that the piano is so big, and the one that you're looking at is obviously in my writing room, but the one that upstairs, we have a U3 upstairs, a Yamaha, that is right at the end of the dining table. You know what I mean? It's just right there at any given moment. You can just sit and pluck away at it for a second and then walk away. And it's funny because my husband, who doesn't play an instrument at all, grew up next to a music teacher. And so when I dust the piano, or like one of the kids just walk by and like hit the keys, it's like one of his favorite things. And he didn't even have a piano in his house. I think it just becomes part of the family. They have spirits, you know, like guitars have spirits too, for sure. And we have guitars everywhere. We're spoiled, you know, that we get to have instruments lying around. But I think the piano just was such a big part of, I always remember coming home and my brother's playing piano.
You talk about your mom quite a bit, and she passed away when you were seven, and she played the piano. Not to make this entire interview about the piano, but I was wondering, like, what happened after that for the piano, like, how the instrument was treated, like, immediately after.
I don't really remember that much about sort of how the dynamic of my house would have changed in those years after, like, right after she passed away. But because my brother Donald and my brother Bob, those are my two oldest brothers, were big piano players, I'm sure it was just still filled with that. You know, my dad didn't play, but my dad walked around and sang a lot. You know, music is such a way to express your feelings, even if you're not a writer, even if you're just a music lover. It's just such a way to express yourselves. And I think that even though I don't specifically remember those times, I just remember my brothers playing when they would get home from work. And I remember when the piano tuner, Mr. Watts, would come over. It was like always a big deal, like the tuner is here. But yeah, I mean, I'm sure there was a missing of her in that instrument, you know, like that, that she wasn't there to play it. But my brothers really filled that void.
Hmm. Your mom's presence in your life and influence has been very strong for you, even though she passed away. And I read that you used to pray to your mom when you were a little kid, and you've written about her a lot. What do you do in your daily life these days to stay connected to her, and how do you work to keep your own kids connected to her?
Well, it's, you know, I think just because I've had so many years of working on that, I feel like I do, I feel very connected to her because of, you know, because it's been so many years at this point. But I also do work on it. You know, I had this great opportunity at the beginning of this year in February to go and be part of this this Nashville community of people in the music business were invited to this retreat that was very like group therapy based, and I had never done anything like that.
Oh wow.
And it was really beautiful and kind of life-changing, and we all had time to do this, but we all had a moment that was focused on whatever we wanted to focus on. So we had gone to all these seminars and all these things, and I realized, like, oh, I feel like my grief process with my mom has been sort of healthy and done because I've written so many songs about her. And then I got there and I was like, oh, maybe it's not done, and that's why I keep writing songs about her. Oh, that's what I'm doing. And so I got to focus on that a little bit and really had a beautiful experience in that, and sort of realizing that I do really feel connected to my mother. And I think in the way I do it is through music, because that's sort of the way I conduct all my emotions is through music. But I feel like because I do music for a living, I'm really blessed in the way that I can spend so much time on something that would otherwise be such a hole, you know, like be such a gap for me. You know, people always tease, like, I keep writing the same song over and over again. So it's funny, I do try to stay away from the death theme sometimes, but it just keeps creeping back. It creeps back.
Happens. Well, you know what, Lori? It happens to everyone.
I just can't help it.
The guitar, you wanted to play guitar like Richie.
Mm-hmm.
What drew you to the guitar other than, you know, Richie played it? And what has your relationship been like with the instrument, and how has it evolved?
The thing about the guitar for me, I guess my thought process was that the music that I was listening to when I was probably past the point where I could take lessons, but I was like 13. And normally you would hope to start maybe a little sooner, but by the time I could figure out how to get a ride to a music class, I was 13. I was like 12 or 13. Normally, you know, younger kids would take music class right after school, and I could never do that because I didn't have a ride. So when I was old enough to take a night music class, like a 7 p.m., because I was old enough to stay up late for that, I was drawn to guitar by that point because I was sort of spending a lot of time listening to what Richie listened to, which was Neil Young and James Taylor, you know, like it was guitar-based music. So I figured, oh, he plays guitar, and it doesn't seem impossible, which, of course, it is. But, you know, when you're that age especially. But I just followed him. I just followed him along.
I want to hear more about how your dad loves musicals.
Oh, my dad. Still, yes.
Like, would he go around the house singing them? And does he still like musicals?
I think he likes opera and classical music, but he was really studied in the musicals. And I think it was something that he could do. He could, like, sort of play around the house that we didn't roll our eyes at too much, you know, as much as the classical music. But he, my dad is the type of singer that, like, vacuums and sings. You know that guy? That, like, the vacuum's so loud that he thinks that you can't hear him, like, singing Man of La Mancha, like, at the top of his lungs. And that's when he, instead of, like, being a shower singer, he was, like, a clean the house singer.
Did he work for Boston Edison?
He did, yeah.
Yeah.
Forever,
so
yeah.
When I read that he loved musicals, it's just, yeah, like, those two things don't necessarily fit together. But
yeah, I know.
I love it.
Computer guy at Boston Edison that loves musicals. Maybe it does.
You started writing songs in elementary school. How did it feel when you wrote your first song? And can you compare it to, like, how you feel now after you've written a song?
Well, that's such a good question, man. I remember that the first couple of songs that I showed anybody were very, like, domestic, like, country-ish songs. And I remember my brothers being really surprised that the song sounded so country, and because I didn't grow up listening to country music at all. But looking back, I think, first of all, I think it was about, there was a rodeo involved in this song, and mm-hmm. I had never been to a rodeo or seen a rodeo, so that's probably where everyone kept coming up with the word country. But it was also this, like, love triangle between a woman, a man, and the rodeo. So, and I was quite young. I was probably, like, 10 or 11. And so I think that they were all like, what's wrong with Laurie? There was some, you know, listening to UMB, because my brother did, you know, back, but I don't even know if it was that age, you know, that we listened. But I just listened to the stuff that he was playing on his record player. And that's what I delivered. And they were like, what's wrong with this child? She's writing songs about love triangles and there's a rodeo involved. So it all makes sense now. But as far as, like, well, how did I feel when I wrote that versus how do I feel now? It's probably very similar, to be honest. It's probably, like, I just love songs. I just love it.
You mentioned WUMB. And radio played a big part for you for being introduced to songwriters. And WUMB is UMass Boston's public radio station. When we were first talking about you coming on the podcast, it was Chris Delmhorst was there and Mark Morelli mm-hmm. was there. And they were both talking about Chris being on the podcast, talking about her experience with Casey Kasem and the oh, and the taping the top 40 and yes. then lying to Casey Kasem in a letter because she wanted to get a Journey song on tape. Anyways,
so
I wanted to know about, like, your experience listening to the radio and your connection to the radio.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I do remember recording songs off the radio, like 100%. Remember that from high school and taping songs and
Was it from WUMB?
No, I think by then it would have been, in those days, it would have been probably whatever, not pop, but whatever, like, the singer, songwriter, I cannot remember even, but, or maybe the top, you know, pop radio back then, I don't even know, but that story, first of all, the idea of Chris Delmhorst actually lying to someone is beyond my comprehension because she's, like, the sweetest, kindest person. I'm sure it's the only lie she's ever told in her life, but I love it that it was based around music and her need for it. But, yeah, I mean, when I discovered that there was other music, you know, but, like, this really different music was starting to seep in when I started paying attention. And my brothers had, I mean, all of my brothers had, you know, a pretty, you know, well-stocked library of, at that point, it was records and a little bit of cassettes, but it was records, you know, and I would sit with my brother and listen to whatever he was listening to, and I think, I still love radio. I still love all sorts of radio. People make fun of me sometimes, but I still love it, And I still love sort of discovering songs that I've never heard before for the first time. I think that's, you know, part of why we all love music.
How much older is Richie than you?
He's 10 years older than me.
Oh, what a nice brother.
Yeah. All my my siblings are great. I lucked out for sure. Yeah.
So there's Marie, Richie, Donald, Bobby, and then what's the other?
David.
David.
David's
the one I didn't know.
Yeah, he's the one that like always misses the pictures when we're at like the wedding and we do the group picture. We can't ever find David. He's like the snuffleupagus of the group.
That's funny. You met your husband Gene in the third grade and you married him when you were 19. Mm. I don't know if you remember meeting him, but what do you remember about knowing that he was like the person that you wanted to marry at such a young age, making that decision?
Well, I think I actually do remember meeting him early on. And the reason I think I remember in like third grade walking down the hallway is it was a moment where when it was just the two of us in the hallway and we were walking across from each other. And I, for some reason, I don't have a great memory. And for some reason, I remember that. And I remember thinking, oh, there's that kid that always like sticks up for the kids that are getting bullied. Because Gene was like always like the bigger kid. He's not very tall, but when he was little, he's stocky, you know? And he had the reddest, curly red hair, freckles, I think glasses. His name's Eugene. I mean, and there I am, like, walking down the hall across from him, thinking, oh, there's that really nice kid. And we really didn't, hang out until we were in high school, even though we lived right around the corner from each other. I mean, we knew each other, but we didn't hang out until high school. And I don't know, I just don't really remember much about life before Gene was in it, to be honest. Mm. I also don't remember life before I had kids.
Can you talk about Gene's feelings about your work and your career and how they may have evolved over time?
Gene has been really good in the way that he is not an editor of what I do, and I think there was so many years. So when we started dating, let's say we were like 16, I had been writing songs since I was, you know, around 11, 12 in there somewhere, writing songs, then learning how to play guitar and then putting them together, just always since I was a little kid. So he knew that that was what, like, something I did all those years before I left the house with music. But it was never like something that I, you know, said, someday I'm going to be a songwriter, or someday I'm going to make a record and be an artist. So when we got married, that wasn't like a discussion at all. And there was so many years, I think, of him not editing me, that when I did start leaving the house and did start sharing music outside of myself, it never clicked in for him to be like, should you say that, or people think you're talking about me? Like, should you really write the bird and the rifle? Because people are going to think I'm the rifle and you're the bird. I'm like, no, it's fine. Or, you know, does every character have to have a drinking problem? Things like that, that I think that somebody else may have tried to edit what I was saying, or tried to like just look too much into it, as in like, are we okay? He always knows that if there's a problem between the two of us, I'm surely not going to explain it to him in song. It just will not come that way. It will be presented in a different manner. So when I write songs, even if they're really sad, or they seem, even if there is a personal part to it, he knows it isn't truly just me and him, you know? And so he's been great as far as that piece, which is huge for me because the songwriting is my favorite part of all this. Everything else that has come along the way, he's either been a trooper about when it came to like me traveling a lot or being gone, or he's been my greatest cheerleader about being like, yeah, you should try that, you know? And not to say that I don't get out of balance sometimes, and he gets mad at me about being out of balance, but I mean, I think that's unavoidable, you know. He's pretty much been a really good he's enjoyed the process, I think.
On confidence and self-worth, when it came to songwriting, you've said, I battled with confidence issues. I didn't know I was worthy of doing it outside my house for the most part. I've been so lucky that the music sort of pulled me. When you started performing out in your late 20s, you started doing open mics, you had 3 kids at the time. Where did you feel the most confident and worthy? And how have you seen your confidence for and worth as a songwriter grow?
My confidence issues have really formed a lot of what I've done when. And I think that sometimes, probably early on, when I would say, oh no, I can't do that, it would be like, oh, I can't do that because I have little kids and it's too hard for me to do that. Which is true, and that works on paper, but there was probably a lot of, like, I don't know if I'm capable of doing that, involved in that. So I did always take a step forward. Like, I always did sort of stick my neck out, I felt like, confidence-wise, and push myself into doing things. And I did have people along the way that would push me, which was great. But I also always had this backup of saying, oh, I can't really do that because I don't have time to do it because I'm raising this family, which of course was always the number one goal anyway. But they kind of went hand in hand. I still feel like I work on confidence issues, but it wasn't until I got to Nashville and I started working with other artists, like, you know, these big artists that wanted to work with me in songwriting or wanted to have me along on the road to help with what they were feeling, and sort of thought, well, if they're, you know, they have all these songwriters at their disposal and they're asking me to be involved, then I must be okay at this. It must be, it's like, it's kept me, you know, out of trouble all this time. I'm always kind of amazed that I get to do it. I still am amazed that I get to do it. But I think my confidence has grown. Bottom line is my confidence has grown, but it's still something that I have to talk to myself about.
Kind of on the opposite of that, a common theme throughout your career has been you following the music, listening to people saying, hey, Laura, you should do this. And then, I mean, I'm sure there have been times where people say, hey, Laura, you should do this. And you're like, no, thanks. But where does that leave your ownership of your successes and creative accomplishments?
Sure. Well, my ownership really is in the work part of it, because I've had so much luck. I've been lucky by those people that said, you should try this. And those, you know, and like even living near Passim, for example, you know, and having a community like the Boston community. And I've been so lucky just from the get-go and all that, but then luckier with like Faith Hill hearing my record and wanting to cut some songs and things like that. That luck has always followed me, but the luck only will work for so long, and at some point you have to do the work. I feel like I've always done the work. My ownership has been in, I've always done the work and I've always tried to get better at it, and that might be where the confidence pushes back a little bit, whereas like I know that I may not be as good as the other person in the room, but I can work my hardest at being as good as I can be. And I've just always, because I love the work, I've always done, I just, you know, I think I just try to do a lot of work behind it, try to grow and try to be a student of the craft and follow the craft.
What do they call that? You've got spirit.
I've got spirit.
Mary Gaucher was the one that started playing your music for people in Nashville. And you two had met in Boston and you kind of came up at the same time, but she was the one that kind of started planting your music in Nashville, and then Faith Hill got her hands on it, and then your life really changed. What does that friendship with Mary mean to you, especially like when you guys were first coming up? What did you like about each other?
Yeah, Mary and I did. She was always a few steps ahead of me when I started doing like open mics. Like I would show up to an open mic and she would be the feature, you know, and things like that. And I would kind of watch her. We were always a little bit older than everybody else there. And
she's about 7 years older than you.
Yeah, is she that much? I don't know. I don't know how old she is.
I looked it up on Wikipedia.
Oh, is that what Wikipedia said? Yeah, yeah. I don't know, but she was always, like, it was like, Mary would kind of stick out. I would stick out because I'm, like, showing up, like, in a minivan and, like, mom clothes with, like, peanut butter and jelly on my guitar case and things like that. And then there'd be all these younger people that, like, were just, you know, in college or, you know, just starting out. And we kind of always stuck out like two sore thumbs in a way. But I always watched her. And the thing, Mary has taught me many lessons, but one of the greatest is that growth. Because every time Mary made a record, it was much better than the record before. Like, she just gets better and better and better and better. And she finds herself more and more and more in everything that she does. It was from watching her. You know, I remember Mary early on. I remember Chris Delmer, so, as we talked about earlier, who I love so much early on. And we have the same birthday, Chris and I. I'm 2 years older than her. Yeah. And
Birthday twins.
And I just went the first time. I remember the first time meeting Chris. My perspective of a young person meeting Chris was like, God, this girl oozes with talent. And then when I met Mary, it was like, wow, this woman's amazing, and she's working her butt off to figure this thing out that she wants to do. My brain would have always just said, you either have the talent or you don't, but Mary taught me that you don't know, talent-wise, you don't know what you have until you pull it out. Like, you have to work, and you have to just... Mary, she's my guardian angel. I literally just talked to her, texted back and forth with her a bunch yesterday. I just love, love, love Mary. And she has been such a good friend. She's the person that will call you and say, hey, man, I had a dream the other night about you, and I was just calling to check on you. And you, like, you're in the middle of something and you need a friend to call. Mary's the one that will call you. She's extraordinary.
Awesome. The thing that people like about your music are the themes of family and domesticity. That's a hard word to say.
It is.
Domesticity.
I wouldn't even try. You're so
Shouldn't
brave.
Shouldn't even be a word. And your home life is the thing that grounds you and is kind of like the secret to your songwriting. And apparently this is something you say took a while for you to figure out. What was that process like, and how did that realization change you?
I think that when I first started out, you know, people would say, write what you know, write what you know, write what you know. And I guess for a while, I didn't know, you know, anything. I guess in the very beginning, I didn't know that much at all. And I think because, like, I talk about Gene being not an editor and not truly listening maybe to everything I say. My kids surely don't listen to everything I say. All right. But I think not having somebody on my back saying, are you sharing too much? Are you like, do you have to pull everything out? You know, I think that, along with finding what I liked in songs, what drew me into other people's songs, when they say these kind of strange, really personal things in your ear pops up, like, what did they say? That doesn't sound like it should be in a song. That sounds like a conversation. And finding out the things that I liked, I just settled into it. You know, now I have to watch myself, because I think we probably have talked about this before, that, like, I love the word kitchen, you know, and it's like, I can't have it in every song. You can't put the word kitchen in every song. But I am drawn back to the same things, you know, like every conversation that I can think of that I had with a family member, or in a joyful moment or a really sad moment, those things happen in a kitchen. Like, why can't we put the kitchen in the song? And it's like, not everyone, you know? I mean, I'm conscious of it, and I try to watch myself, that I need to find other characters. I need to, like, think outside of my own little bubble sometimes. But I'm so domestic because I'm so domestic. I mean, I think that's just it. I'm just in that world.
What is your experience like in terms of, like, feminism? I don't know if you consider yourself a feminist, and what have your thoughts been on, like, the evolution of the movement?
You know, I don't know that much about the movement as far as historically, because I probably have been, again, that bubble, you know, that I've realized this year especially, I'm in such a bubble, you know, and probably haven't spent enough time knowing what women have gone through or the steps they've had to take to get, you know, to for someone like me to live the life that I haven't enjoyed. And this year's been, you know, I have four brothers and a sister, and I have four sons and a daughter. And this year has been such an awakening in just everything. Watching my girl, her name's Megan, she's a freshman in college, just, you know, moved away to college and experiencing.
Where is she going?
She's going to UNH and University of New Hampshire. And nice. So she's not too far away, and she's loving it so far. But watching her, you know, my kids have always taught me more than I've taught them, but watching the world and what's happening to us this year with her has been much more of a learning experience for me than it would have been without sharing it with her. I always would have stayed away from the word feminist, but it's an important word, and it's like it really has to be an important part of. We have to know the stories, you know. We have to know why things that are political cannot just be something that works for you or works for your family or you thought works for you. And she's educated me more than I have educated her. It's been amazing in a lot of ways. You know, as far as the industry, the music industry and women, in Nashville, the conversation is, why are there not more women played on the radio? But I'm in the songwriter community, and I write with just as many women as I do men. So it's like, I always feel like I could keep a safe distance from those things in the past, before this year, of course, because music doesn't really have a gender. Feelings, you know, described in a song, it could be written by a man. Like in a writing room, I guess what I'm trying to say is, in a writing room, it isn't like, oh, we have two men here and a woman. It's like we have three songwriters here, you know. And I think that's kind of been my road in music, is I haven't seen a lot, I haven't experienced a lot of issues with women not being treated fairly in my industry. But that doesn't mean it's not happening to other people in my industry, and of course in all these other parts of industry and all the everyone else's bubbles. So this year has been a getting out of the bubble, trying to figure out the best way to experience other people's stories and really listen. I didn't really answer your question very well, but that's where I'm at.
That's totally cool. I remember you used to come to WERS, and I would host the coffee house. The one time that I really remember, Megan was just born, she was like on your back
probably,
and now she's like in college,
now
which
she's
is crazy.
In college.
Also, I want to say that did you name her Megan after Megan Toohey?
Yes, she's named Megan Elizabeth after Megan Elizabeth Toohey. Yes.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And it's funny. It's so funny. I mean, I love Megan so much. And she, Megan was, you know, my pal. Like, she was in the front seat of my car forever, you know, driving to shows and doing shows together. And she taught me so much about, like, being young. I got married when I was 19, so I didn't go to college. I didn't, like, have an apartment in Jamaica Plain. You know what I mean? So I would go to her apartment and be like, this is what happens? Like, you have a sofa? And you know what I mean? Like, as I went from, like, my father's house to, you know, having, I think we had two kids by the time we moved out of my dad's house and moved into our house. And it was like, I experienced so much through watching Megan Toohey just as a 20-something in Boston, you know?
Oh,
she's just awesome. I love her.
Yeah, me too. And also, is it a coincidence that you have four sons and one daughter, and your daughter is the youngest. Did you just like, you're like, okay, I have a daughter now, I can stop having children?
Well, actually, she's the second to youngest. So I had, we had three kids.
Oh,
yeah. Okay. This is what happened, is we had three, because sometimes people think I have two husbands. Well, two marriages, because there's a gap. That we had three kids, and we thought we were done. And then 7 years later, we had Megan. And I didn't want her to be alone. So I was like, we have to have another kid. And so my youngest is a boy. My youngest is David, because he's my fourth boy. And in my family, my brother David was the fourth boy. So that's why his name is David. He's named after my brother. But yeah, it is. But it is funny. Like, she's, when I was traveling a lot when she was little, she'd be so sick of all the boys in the house, and I would say, Megan, I have four brothers, and I lived, so you're gonna be okay.
I feel for her. Yeah.
She's done well. Yeah. She's done well.
Okay, new album, Balladeer. I have some questions about a couple of these songs.
Okay.
Is this my favorite Lori McKenna record, or is it Paper Wings and Halo?
Oh, I thought you were asking me.
Yeah, that's the first question.
That's the first
question.
Is
this my favorite Lori McKenna
yes,
record?
Yes, it is. It is.
Okay, great. I want to ask you about the title track, The Balladeer. It's a character song that is not you. You say, I don't know who she is, but I love her.
I don't.
Which you also posted on your Instagram recently, that you say that too much to people, that you love them.
I know, but I'm doing it. I'm sorry. I just love people. Yeah.
Yeah. So this character, you don't know who she is, but you love her. What do you love about her? Like, what breaks your heart about her? How do you relate to her?
What happened was this song came from the title. I saw, you know, we've seen that, The Balladeer, we've seen it, you know, over the years. I've seen it so many times. And I saw it somewhere, and I was like, oh, that would be a great song title. And it started really quickly. Like, I think by the second line, I knew, well, she can't be me. Because that would be too weird, and I write too much about myself anyway. But I think that the story that came out in her, I've seen in different people's stories. You know, the whole, someone falls for you just as you are, you evolve, and the, you know, and then, you know, they want the old you back, or something like that. And or you grapple with finding joy, putting yourself out there, and then as soon as you do, you know, something terrible happens, and you have to go back to your safe ways of being miserable. But I really love writing character songs, and I don't know if I have quite a few of them, but I have a few of them that I can think of, and I think that those people, when I see them, well, first
Should
of all,
name the character songs.
It's oh, sure.
The Balladeer.
Yeah.
Wreck You
is, yes, but I didn't clearly see that person as clearly as other characters.
The other one that comes to mind is Hardly Speaking a Word.
Hardly Speaking a Word is such an old song, and wow, you just went right back there.
That's right. Paper Wings and Halo.
Well, Numbered Doors is a character song, and The Bird and the Rifle. And those are songs where I really did see. There's also a song I wrote with Drew Kennedy called Rose of Jericho, which is very character-driven. And I just saw those, you know, characters so clearly. And I wanted her to have an evolution. I wanted her to ultimately know that she was okay as herself, you know, which is why she goes back to, you know, writing sad songs and not being for everybody else. I don't know if it comes through necessarily in the song, but that's where I saw her. I saw her having this journey of, like, falling in love and then getting pulled in all these different directions. Like, you could do this, you could do that, you could travel the world, you could be a big star, and then ultimately her finding that she's okay just as her own beautiful balladeer self.
The song When You're My Age, from reading about you, it seems as though when you write a song that you're like, okay, Tim McGraw or Little Big Town, they're going to do this song, so I'll let them do this song, and then you might record a version, like Humble and Kind, you recorded a version.
Mm-hmm.
But When You're My Age, I'm surprised that this song, you didn't save this song for like a big super country star because it's so goddamn good.
Well, thank you.
And you wrote it with the Love Junkies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I love the story of how Hillary was like, no, we're not doing this.
Yeah.
And then Liz, did Liz sing the first?
Like, she did. Like, she started singing, you'll outgrow your shoes, you'll outgrow your bed, you'll outgrow this house. The funny thing about that song is I had the first verse and the last verse. And there was no middle verse. And I had no chorus and I didn't know what to do. And as I was playing, it was started on piano. I was playing it on Liz's piano and they were across the room from me. And Liz started singing along with me. Like, when it gets to, like, riding your bike out in the street and playing in the backyard, Liz was singing. And I remember Hillary looking at her like, have you heard this before? Like, how are you singing? And Liz is like, I know what she's going to do. Like, I know her so well. I know what she's going to do. And then I stopped because that was all I had. And Hillary's like, no, you just got to finish that. And Liz is like, no, you'll outgrow your shoes, you'll outgrow your bed, you know, I know exactly where your brain's going. And then we were stuck again, and Hillary found the, you know, we can go back to when you're my age if we just say, she thought it was stupid, she's like, this is so dumb, but we could say, you'll always be my baby, even when you're my age. And when she said it, we all cried, like, we were like, what did you just say?
And the deal was sealed.
And the deal was sealed, so.
I also read about the production process on that track, and it sounds very cool. Like, Dave Cobb heard it and was like, let's make this a piano song. You shouldn't play the guitar. And you also had a hard time, like, not crying when recording it.
Yeah, there's a video that Becky Fluke made for that song, and you can kind of, she filmed the first go round and you can kind of see where I kind of lose it for a minute, but I've cried so many times singing songs, it's ridiculous. I should be over these things by now, but it's funny that I think what Dave Cobb wanted to do in recording was he didn't want me to worry about playing guitar, and he wanted to make sure that I was letting myself be as emotional as possible and just singing. You know, because you're not at, your hands aren't busy. You don't know what to do with your hands. You're just sitting there like, okay, I guess I just have to sing. And plus the piano's so, such an emotional instrument. But yeah, I think we went through it a few times for sure because I would sort of lose it. And the other thing about that band is they're following me. That's why there's so much space there because I couldn't breathe, you know, the first couple of times getting through. And it was
the deal was sealed.
But back to your original point about that song is Tim McGraw did hear that song very early on, and I think he actually cut a version of that song. But it is a 5-minute song, and I talked to Tim a few times about it, and he was such a fan of it and so supportive. But eventually, when I went in to record, I called and, you know, said, what's the deal with when you're my age? You know, what are you thinking, pal? And he was like, I just think you have to do it. And I don't know if Little Big Town heard it before I cut it, but Tim did, and we did have, you know, some chats about that song.
How do you think that writing songs has made you a better mom?
Well, I think anybody that has an outlet where you are really piecing together the way you feel about something, like journaling or anything like that, I think it helps in every relationship you have. If you take time to sit down and really piece together how you feel about something. I mean, like, I always kid, you know, my husband works for the gas company, and I always kid around with him and think, say, like, I just spent 6 hours with somebody, like, pulling apart one emotion and putting it back together. So it's like, you know, you know, my husband's job, he doesn't get to sort of, you know, touch base with his emotions on a daily basis so much. And we're really lucky that we have this. And so I think it's important for anybody to take time and sort of, maybe they don't write it down, maybe they make art or something else. And there's obviously a million ways to do this. But I think those of us that get to sort of work in our emotions are blessed in that way, that we get to sort of pull them apart. I think being a mom has made me a better songwriter, more than being a songwriter has made me be a better mom, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But I think it's just made me pay attention more to being a person.
One of my favorite Lori McKenna stories. So first of all, you're like an icon in Cambridge. I've got two stories that demonstrate this. Once I was at the Kendall Cafe watching a songwriter play, and he was like, this is by a musician that I really love and respect. It's a song called Paper Wings. And I saw two people sit in the corner, and the guy whispered to the lady, Lori McKenna? It was Gillian Welch. By the way, Paper Wings. They were thinking of, what were they thinking of? Paper Wings and Halo. That's right. The second story is, this is my favorite story. The time that you brought Mandy Moore to Club Passim.
I forgot about, to see Daryl Scott.
To see Daryl Scott. Nobody knew who Mandy Moore was, and everyone was freaking out that Lori McKenna was there.
That is not true. That is so not true.
Swear to God. You gotta ask Matt Smith. That's a true story.
That is funny.
All this is leading up to, can you talk about how nice Mandy Moore is?
Oh my God. She's the greatest. She's the sweetest person. And I will say, she was one of the first people that, famous people that I spent time walking in public with. You know what I mean? And it's a tough gig being famous. Like, I would never, ever want to have to worry about that. I feel so bad for famous people. They can't really walk down the street that much. Now they can if they have masks on, if they're paying, you know, being a good citizen. But Mandy's the sweetest. She's so talented. She's such a hard worker. She came a couple of times to Stoughton to write for different albums, and we just hit it off. I mean, she actually has way more patience in songwriting than I do. Way more patience. She'll spend so much time just waiting and finding the right line. And she also really could probably just do it all on her own. But she enjoys the community of having a writing community. And she enjoys that that back and forth, and that maybe an acting thing, that comes from that. I'm not sure. But she really could just do it all alone. And she takes the time to bring people in and share her experience with people. And it's been a blast.
Okay, tell me a story that's going to blow Mark Arely's mind.
That's hard to do, you know. He knows pretty much all my stories, I think. Do you have a story that will blow Mark Arely's mind?
I wonder if the Mandy Moore, Lori McKenna Passim story will blow his mind.
Yeah, I didn't know. I think you're wrong. I think you're wrong about that story. I will tell you this, and I probably have told Mark Arely this, that I think Daryl Scott should probably have a restraining order against me, because every time I see him, I'm like, hi, Daryl, it's me. It's Lori McKenna.
Do you remember me?
We wrote a couple of times together. He's just so good. He's so good. And she happened to be here writing, and I was like, you'll never believe who's playing at Passim. Daryl Scott. I mean, come on, you know?
Okay, Lori McKenna, will you do the lightning round?
Oh, yes. I'm probably going to be terrible at this.
Here we go.
Oh, boy.
First song you learned on the guitar.
First song I learned on guitar was Neil Young, Only Love Can Break a Heart.
What is your karaoke song?
I don't have a karaoke song, but if I had a karaoke song, it would probably be I Can't Make You Love Me. Is that a karaoke song? Is that karaokeable?
Yes.
It's just the best song in the whole world, so.
Mine is Fleetwood Mac's Silver Springs.
Oh, beautiful. Good choice.
So, dogs or cats or something else?
Dogs, 100%. Although we have a guinea pig that's about 10 years old, and he's the sweetest thing in the whole world.
A 10-year-old guinea pig?
Yeah, I don't know how he's still alive. I think it's because we feed him, like, vegetables. I think they'll live forever if you feed them vegetables.
Oh, and not pellets.
Right, the pellets aren't good.
That's a good call. We'll do another podcast.
About guinea pigs?
About your guinea pig.
It's actually a girl. Her name's Flo.
It's a girl named Flo?
Her name's Flo Taco, because she's my son's, and he likes Flo from that commercial, so that's where that came from.
Oh.
10 years ago.
How do you take your coffee?
Black.
Wow. Favorite U.S. city?
Favorite U.S. city? Boston. Has to be Boston.
First album you bought with your own money?
Oh, brilliant question. Susan Vega. No, probably Police. I bought all of the Police records on my own, I bet. Yeah.
Does Gene like the part in Roxanne where Sting accidentally sits on the piano?
I don't think so. I don't think he knows that part.
You should play it for him.
I will.
Do you know that part?
No, but now that you said that, I literally just vinyled up on that. So we'll go check that out. Where is it at?
It's right at the beginning. It's like, bam, 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 and then he goes, blah,
oh,
and then he laughs.
I thought that was on purpose. That's a mistake.
It was an accident.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's a great story.
Right?
Yeah,
that's happy accident.
Mm-hmm.
First concert.
First concert was U2 at the Boston Garden, and I was literally in the very last row, like back to the cement. Center stage, very last row.
Wow, I can relate. I also had similar seats to a U2 concert, but probably a different one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she would have been a very, very baby if ever born.
was it the Joshua Tree?
It was. It was probably in like 84. So whatever.
Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
What is your dream collaboration?
Living or dead?
Either.
Levon Helm.
Flying or invisibility?
Flying.
Star Trek or Star Wars?
Star Wars.
Last one. Where's the most beautiful place you've ever visited?
Oh, the most beautiful place I've ever visited. We took a family vacation to Italy, loved everything about it, but if I had to just pick one spot, it would be Zion Canyon.
Nice.
Gorgeous, yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Lori McKenna, for doing the lightning round. You did great.
I'm so bad at that stuff.
No, it was awesome. And thank you for talking to me for so long.
Oh my God, thank you.
Being such an icon, and also, would you and Dave Cobb and Chris Delmhorst do a re-recording of Fireflies just like you did on the Respond record?
Oh my God, that's a great idea. I should try to make that happen. That's a good idea.
Because it's not on Spotify.
It isn't? I don't know these things.
It's not. The Respond version is not on Spotify, but...
I wonder why whoever's is in charge. Yeah. I should try to make that happen. I'll put that on my list.
Okay.
That'd be fun.
Thanks, Lori.
Thank you.
Basic Folk this week was produced by Laura McCarthy, who also offers her social media help. Lindsay Myers is our business manager. Alex Stanton of Townspeople does our music. Basic Folk is proud to be on the American Songwriter Podcast Network. I'm your host, Cindy House, and I'm talking to you from the past, so I'm crossing my fingers that we are in a better place in our country than where we have been the past 4 years. But also, I am watching a stink bug crawl across the table as I record this in my attic, so that could also be where we are. All right, I will talk to you next time. Thank you for listening, and take care of each other. Okay, bye.